Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. I am your host, Scott Pianowski. It is Monday, August 3rd, and we're going to have a bucket list guest today. We're going to have one of the most important people in fantasy baseball as a writer, publisher, thinker. You know Ron Chandler as an FSWA Hall of Famer, the founder of Baseball HQ, Tout Wars founder, among many innovations. He gave us the Lima plan in the late 90s and, of course, demolished everybody in fantasy leagues with it and a bunch of other stuff. A New York Mets fan and somebody I've been really thrilled just to get to know over the past couple of decades because he means so much to our industry. And I'm thrilled we can talk to him today. Ron Chandler, how you doing?
I'm doing fine under the circumstances. Thanks for having me on, Scott. This is going to be fun.
It is going to be fun. And I promise we're going to have some fun. In fact, we're going to have a draft at the end that is going to be the Jose Lima breakout draft. And I think you know why we're going to go to that. I've given Ron exclusive rights. I've never done this before in our draft. I've never given somebody exclusive rights to draft a player, but I feel like I can't draft Jose Lima. I feel like he in perpetuity belongs to Ron. Before we get to some of the fun stuff and we get to some of the things that we want to talk about that maybe a little bit more put a smile on your face, 2020 is the strangest year of our lives. I don't know how else to phrase it. We weren't sure if there's going to be a baseball season. They eventually got something off the ground. That plane is still in the air, but you know there may be a little bit of chop right now. Some teams aren't playing. Every day just feels like there's new news. We're not sure where things are headed. So, Ron, I just want to see where you're at, where you're at with fantasy in 2020. Did you play less this year? Are you a little bit less engaged? Look, I see a game at Fenway, I'm excited. I see a walk-off home run or a diving stop at shortstop. The baseball instincts kick in. But yet in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, is this going to last? Is this really, for a fantasy season, does this feel like a true winner if somebody wins a two-month season? Just give me a sense of where you're at in 2020.
Well, I'm trying to avoid the dark cloud that's kind of hanging over us there. I'm in five leagues this year, which is a pretty typical number for me. Four of them drafted before baseball shut down in March, so they were pretty much locked in. And the only other one was my local league, which I'm the commissioner of. And the only accommodation I made in that league, it's a head-to-head league, and I just didn't feel like head-to-head really was a format that would work really well with such a short season. So we've moved from the head-to-head to rotisserie this year, which kind of gives me a little bit of an advantage because I've been playing roto for 35 years, and all the guys in this league have only played head-to-head. But I think there's just so much variance inherent in the 60-game season that it levels the playing field no matter what format you play. But, you know, for me, the short season is what it is. You know, we all play different game formats. We have to adjust to different rules. I just see the season as a different challenge. You know, we have to get used to different statistical benchmarks and the fact that there's so much more uncertainty and more surprises. You know, it's just something we have to live with. But, you know, it's also allowing us to do things that we never even consider doing in a full season competition, like drafting to a schedule, which, you know, we do in DFS all the time, but never even thought of doing in a full season. And that's a nice little wrinkle, I think. You know, it's something different. And from, I guess, a purely baseball perspective, I have to be honest, I love the short season. I absolutely love it. I think the compressed schedule fits so much better into what drives us today. You know, we have shorter attention spans. We crave immediate gratification. It's, you know, it's who we are, and I think we need to own it. So I'd love the 7-inning games. I wish they all were 7 innings. I know I'm a heretic, but I think we're too stuck in history, and it keeps us from seeing what a great opportunity this season is providing us to look at other possibilities. So I'm in. I just hope we can get the whole thing in.
Yeah, I think you make a great point. I've seen that, you know, look, baseball, right? They're trying things. There's an extra inning rule that they're implemented. The new rule with relief pitchers, the 7-inning games for the doubleheaders. Some of this stuff will stick. Some of it won't stick, but why shouldn't we be doing the same thing for fantasy, trying different things? And, you know, for people out there who haven't started their fantasy football leagues, maybe it's a year to try something different. If you like it, if it works, great. If it doesn't, then maybe next year you do something different.
Absolutely. It's we have to think outside the box, and I hate that phrase, but it's something that we're being given a unique opportunity to do that this year, and we should take it.
Yeah, let's definitely steer into that. You had a recent tweet a couple of days ago, which I thought was very insightful. I'm just going to quote from it. During, this is Ron Chandler tweeting at Ron Chandler, R-O-N-S-H-A-N-D-L-E-R. During a normal season, overanalysis of the first week of stats is annoying. This season, it seems like there's hyperanalysis going on. Just because the season is 63% shorter doesn't mean we need to squeeze in 63% more analysis, end quote. I think you're spot on with what you're saying here, but it also makes me wonder, short of an obvious injury, what would lead you to proactively think about changing your opinion on a player? You know, an influx of playing time, could it be a velocity gain or dip? Some of the strikeout and walk metrics do stabilize fairly quickly. We're not quite at that point yet, but I'm just curious. I mean, look, we'd like to have proof. We'd like to have a lot of data to work with. We're not going to get to that point with most of these stats this year. So what types of things could you be looking at when it comes to making decisions on pickups or roster decisions? What are we looking at when we don't have that much data to work with?
Well, really all of the above. From my perspective, I don't really see that big of a difference from how we'd normally play it, with the single exception that we just have to make decisions quicker. So we're not going to have the data that we need, which means we're more likely to get it wrong. And since playing time and roles are just so much more fluid this season, that risk level is ramped up even more. But I think the point I was making in that tweet was that I'm seeing things like so-and-so is in a deep slump because he's gone 0-for-9. Or I saw a note the other day that said one player was struggling after going 5-for-22, but another player was playing great after going 6-for-23.
And one hit.
One hit. You know, and yeah, there's a perceptible difference between 227 and 260, but I mean, really now, one hit, one at bat. So, and I don't recall ever seeing it this bad in April. I think that because we need to make these quicker decisions, everyone's in a rush to pass judgment on whether these early performances are real or flukes. But you know, jumping to conclusions after 20 at bats isn't any more accurate now than would be in April.
I didn't send this over in the pregame script that I sent to you, which is of course in pencil anyway. We're going to go to organic spots. We've never seen as much save striation as we see right now. More pitchers get saves. More teams are being open-minded with their bullpen usage. And you know, after maybe being frustrated by this in recent seasons, I just kind of said, I'm just going to accept it. It seems like stolen bases and saves, I'm just going to need less to be competitive, and a player can be a partial contributor in both, and then I might want them on my roster. Speaking specifically to bullpen saves, I forget where you came down on the whole idea. Where is Ron Chandler at right now when it comes to chasing saves?
Well, I've kind of been a proponent for changing that category to saves plus holds now for several years. And holds are an imperfect category, but saves now have become a highly imperfect category as well. And the advantage of having a category like saves plus holds is it allows you to cast a wider net out over the entire bullpen and capture more players and give value to more players. And given now that we're trying to play whack-a-mole with the closers, there's enough uncertainty in this game as it is, and even more so this season, that you know, we need a little bit of accommodation in order to be able to compete and control and manage our team. So, yeah, you know, saves have been tough this year. You try to get the anchor guy and maybe take a chance on a second tier guy, you know. But hey, I spent all this on Kirby Yates, and I'm not doing too well with that right now.
Right. I don't think anybody saw that coming. I mean, you famously said a long time ago, you said, look, let's draft skills, let's not draft roles. And I think that's such a great piece of advice for any fantasy sport. But with closers, the role is a huge part of it, right? I mean, you don't necessarily have to be a great pitcher if your manager is just going to throw you out there in a 3-run lead the ninth inning and you just don't have to throw up all over yourself and you get the save. That's the one thing. I mean, normally just drafting those skills, I'm all for it. But it's a little bit of a wrench when, again, you don't have to be the best pitcher on your team. You know, maybe Lugo is the best Mets relief pitcher right now. Does that mean he'll be the closer? Does that mean he won't be the closer because they want to use him in a high leverage situation, rove him all over the place? Draft skills, not roles, I think is great advice. It's funny how sometimes the save chase kind of warps that a little bit.
Well, sure. But, you know, we're playing this game and we have to cling on to anything that gives us some semblance of control. And in tracking players' skills, that gives us some semblance of control because we kind of have a feel for how players are going to fare when they're on the mound. We know some pitchers are better than others. Some players are better than others. But to get inside a manager's head and know who he's thinking about for the role, we don't have any control over that. So the best we can do is just grasp onto what we can control and then just do as much contextual analysis as we can and hope for the best. You know, one of the best things we can do is pray a lot because that's all we can count on.
You know, before the season, when I looked at the San Francisco Giants roster, especially after Buster Posey opted out, I don't think they had a top 300 player in ADP. This team was just a wasteland, and they're in the midst of a rebuild. It's going to be a few years probably before they're competitive again. And I thought the one thing about San Francisco that maybe I could hang my hat on is that, you know, big park, there's not going to be a lot of run scoring. Maybe I'll stream a pitcher here or there, that type of thing. Well, they've made some changes to the park, and they brought the fences in a little bit, but I didn't think that was going to be a big deal. I'll be honest with you. I did not factor that into any analysis as far as games in San Francisco. But what I didn't know is they closed off some archways in this stadium. And we're just talking about four games so far, but the ball is flying out of San Francisco. And I, when I say this, I'm seeing right-handed hitters hit home runs that seemed impossible previously in San Francisco. Now, Fernando Tatis is a wonderful talent. When he takes in a middle in slider and takes it out to the park to right field, maybe it's just because he's a great player. But I've seen a couple of right-handed batters not even square the ball up and get it out in right field. I've certainly seen some lefty guys knocking the ball like crazy out of there. It's four games. I know this goes against anything. Any stat person is going to say, hey, you know, four games, what are you, crazy? I mean, you can't make any, you know, I mean, maybe it's just one of those days where the pitchers weren't pitching well. The strike zone was limited. I mean, it could be so many different things. But I don't think Dwayne Kuiper and Mike Krukow are generally alarmists. They're the Giants announcers. They've been all over this all week. And I'll tell you, I'm starting to think differently. In fact, in some DFS contests, I very liberally used Rangers the past few games. And again, maybe it's the Giants can't pitch. It could be a lot of things. But, you know, I got a Chu home run out of that. I got a couple of Gallo home runs out of that. Do you have any thoughts on what seems to be happening in San Francisco?
Well, again, four games. We really can't draw any conclusions. But, you know, you know as well as anyone what happened in Fenway Park when they built the 600 Club.
Right.
So wind currents have a lot of impact potentially on how the ball travels, and structural changes can alter the wind currents. San Francisco, just in general, is a pretty windy place. So this could be real. It absolutely could be. But I was just before we hopped on this pod, I was just on a conference call with the guys from Baseball HQ talking about this. And they think some of the modifications had something to do with COVID protection, that they might be temporary. I didn't have time to check if that was true.
Interesting.
But if that's true, then these could be temporary. But clearly, if they've closed off some avenues of wind currents, this could be real.
You know, one of the players I specifically had trouble with the Giants this year as far as what to do with them is Mike Yastrzemski. Age 29 season last year, had a nice year for the Giants, had no pedigree previously. I mean, obviously, his grandfather was Carl Yastrzemski, Hall of Famer, 1967 Triple Crown winner. But nobody thought Mike Yastrzemski was a prospect. And when we see a guy who's got no pedigree, no real track record, has a nice little season at age 29, it's just hard to put a value on him. I have him in a couple of leagues, but I by no means targeted him. He's played great for a couple of weeks, a two-week sample, whatever that means. What do you do when somebody, I mean, you know, sometimes guys, you know, what Whit Merrifield was a late bloomer, Nelson Cruz took a while for him to find his stride, Raul Ibanez had a great 30s, wasn't much of a player in his 20s. I'm not saying Yastrzemski is going to maybe be as good as any of those guys, but what do we do when somebody has no pedigree, no track record, and then all of a sudden at age 29, they're pretty good, and so far into his age 30 season, he's going to be 30 at the end of the month. Mike Yastrzemski looks like one of those league-winning players. How do we handle guys like this?
I mean, there are always guys that come out of the woodwork. I like to call these older prospects Bull Durham prospects. You know, they emerge late, usually well after they've been written off. And there is this really small window that they might have a few productive years. I mean, you mentioned some perfect examples. I had like Adam Duvall to that list. I mean, came out of nowhere, a couple of good seasons now. He's almost irrelevant. I think Christian Walker is probably falls into that same group now. I mean, it's from a fantasy perspective, I think you ride these guys out and you bail at the first sign of a fall off. So yeah, I mean, that's the best you can do. There are always going to be surprises like that.
Now, we also know that one of our favorite things in fantasy is when a post-hype sleeper puts it together. Again, we're talking about tiny samples here, but J.P. Crawford at one point was a very ballyhooed prospect with the Phillies for different reasons. Nothing really worked out for him. Now he's off to a good start, hitting well over 300 in Seattle. He's been moved up to the leadoff spot. I saw him steal two bases in a game a few days ago, and stolen bases are so rare in today's game that I feel like every stolen base I should at least look at. When somebody steals two bases, I mean, it gets me out of my chair. It makes me think. In the case of Crawford, I thought, okay, had a pedigree at one point. He's still pretty young. He's been moved up in the lineup. He seems interested in running. I stopped my analysis right there and just said, okay, is he available anywhere? Because I think I'm interested in some of my deeper mixed leagues. I think he's worth a pickup now. He's probably about 25% rostered in Yahoo at the moment, but I felt like he checked a lot of the boxes. Any interest in Crawford or this type of post-hype sleeper? Are these some of the clues we should be looking at?
Oh, absolutely. I think he just needed to get out of Philadelphia. And, you know, even last year, even though his end-of-season numbers weren't all that great, he showed some small signs of light during certain stretches last year. And I had him on my roster for part of last year, waiting for him to sustain those surges, which he didn't. But I mean, he had a pretty good first half, pretty lousy second half, but there was always something there. And like you said, he had a pedigree. With guys like that, I always have to remind myself that these top prospects, they don't always hit the ground running, so to speak. I mean, that sometimes they take longer. They, you know, we want that immediate gratification, but some guys just take longer than others. I mean, I'm the guy who's had Ahmed Rosario on my roster for like 14 years. At least it feels like that. So, yeah, I mean, I'm full in on Crawford. I think he's going to be very good.
Yeah, I think it could be a fun season for him. I'm still a pro Rosario guy, too. It can be tricky with shortstop prospects sometimes because a lot of times their standing in the prospect community can be tied to defense. I think when Lindor came up and people thought, this guy's going to be a great defender, not sure how much he'll hit. And what's happened, the defense is still nice, but now, you know, we think of Lindor, we think, man, he could win the AL MVP in any season.
Yeah. I mean, in general, we say about prospects, you know, defense is what gets them to the majors and offense keeps them there. So, sure.
Yeah, very, very well put. Among many things that you've pioneered, many things that you've coined, many things that you've taught us, the Lima Plan, 1998, a watershed year in fantasy baseball, you put together. Pitching staff didn't seem to have a lot of juice on opening day. And then and not that much later, you wrote an article called The Secret to My Crappy Pitching Staff, and the Lima Plan was born. Before I talk about where the Lima Plan has led, just give our listeners just a who may not, you know, who may be newer players, who maybe don't know the Lima Plan as intimately as we do, just give a quick synopsis of what that was.
Sure. Lima Plan, Lima is an acronym for Low Investment Mound Aces. And essentially, back in the 1990s, we typically drafted starting pitchers based upon their win totals and their ERA. Those were the stats that we played the game with. And so those were the stats we looked at. So we were looking for number one and number two starters, those type of guys with the firm roles. But what we were ignoring is that sometimes they didn't have the underlying support metrics to sustain the levels that we were putting up. So the Lima Plan basically says, look for the support metrics, draft based on the support metrics, ignore wins, ignore ERA, and you could assemble a very, very good pitching staff for maybe $60 out of your $260 budget and contend. And that kind of worked out for a few years.
I believe in 98 was the year you won both American League and National League Tout Wars. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, man, what a double that is. Now, the problem, if you're Ron Chandler and you come out with a Lima Plan and you tell everybody about it, and then, you know, you're at this point, you're the publisher of Baseball HQ, you put out, they still put out this great annual. You know, all your stuff is open book and people are co-opting the plan and they're understanding it. And then they want to know, you know, who does Chandler like this year? What did the forecaster project for this player? So now all this stuff is out there. And you're a target because, hey, this guy just won all these expert leagues and, you know, he got Jose Lima out of nowhere. How do you adjust to that? When all your notes are open to everybody in the world and people, because this is what we do in life, right? We see somebody successful and we try to say, what does he know? What does she know? Let's copy what they do. And for a long time, I think there was nobody more copied than you. How do you adjust to that?
Well, I try to get into leagues where nobody knows me. It's quite a trick. To be absolutely honest, I got into this business because so I could support my family doing something I love. And so my loyalty has always been to my readers. This is all I've been doing since 1994. So everything I do is to support the website and the book and all my other content worked. My fantasy success has been scattershot. I mean, basically, luckily I did well when it counted. A lot of it is just luck and timing. So I published that article, The Secret of My Crappy Pitching Staff, and put together the Lima Plan. And, you know, it's 1998. It changed my life. I won like 5 experts league titles in 4 years, but since then only like 2 or 3. But that's okay, because the process of trying to find that next great thing has been a journey that I've found very interesting, and thankfully my readers have found pretty interesting too. And each of these little sub plans or small little strategies that I've developed along the way, a lot of readers have found success with the broad assessment balance sheet, BABS, that I write about now at BABSBaseball.com has been doing pretty well for the last few years. So, I keep trying different things. And, but the great thing about Lima is that, the underlying concepts are still valid, even 2 decades later. You know, I take a look, and every time I see an opponent who overpays for a pitcher who has big wins and a low ERA, but terrible support metrics, I'm looking at Rick Porcello right now. it's the Lima plan that gave me and gave everybody the knowledge and that edge to know that don't target that guy. Look at someone else.
Right. I don't think you get enough credit sometimes for, I think you were first person who understood what strand rate was. Can you explain that and how that's a valuable tool in the toolbox for fantasy players?
I always wondered why a lot of pitchers would do well in ERA, but not in WHIP. Or vice versa, good WHIP, low ERA, bad ERA, high WHIP. And the difference really is the percentage of base runners that they were able to strand. And so I did some research in the 1990s and determined that if a pitcher was able to strand the 75% or more of his base runners, he tended to have an artificially low ERA. Or if he stranded fewer than 65% of his base runners, he had an artificially high ERA. And that would tend to normalize over time. So that was another way to target pitchers who had good underlying metrics, say, and a 60 or 65% strand rate. They had the potential to do better the following year. And that worked out pretty well.
Talking to Ron Chandler, one of the just most important people in the fantasy baseball publishing space, and somebody who's been playing for a long time, obviously the founder of Baseball HQ, the founder of Tout Wars, and find all his work at ronchandler.com. You can follow him on Twitter at Ron Chandler. So, Ron, I got into the game a little bit later than you, but by the late 80s, I was playing fantasy baseball, and by the early 90s, I was pretty consumed by it. And I thought in the early days of me playing, the first edge I could get was just having information. That was reading the USA Today notes in spring training, or having a friend who lives in Minnesota and says, something's going on with the Twins. Let me tell you about it. I was on Prodigy when a lot of people weren't online. So again, that information was the way, was my edge in the early days. And then everybody got online and that kind of went away. And then I thought, okay, oh, metrics, you know, I'm a Baseball HQ subscriber. I got a metric advantage, you know, or maybe if I was early to Fangraphs or early to Baseball Savant, whatever it was, that was a great edge. And look, even though Ron's not at Baseball HQ anymore, technically, there's still so much talent there. I just want to give a shout out to those guys.
For sure.
I have great respect for those people. And you should read, you know, Ray Murphy, Ryan Bloomfield. I go on and on. Patrick Davitt's podcast is outstanding. I just much love to HQ. So I thought information used to be what was my secret sauce. And then it was metrics, and metrics are always going to be important. But now I feel there's so much good free information. Even I feel like the person who was the weakest player in your league back a long time ago was just going to get trampled. they couldn't compete. And I feel like now the quote unquote weakest person in the league still has a lot of free information that even if they're not trying that hard, they can probably get a good cheat sheet or they can probably get a good set of rankings. What do you think the edges in fantasy, I mean, maybe I'm understating how much of the edges are the same, but I feel like the information edge is kind of out the window. And I feel like the metric edge has at least been mitigated somewhat. What's the fantasy edge in 2020?
I think it's still there. In many ways, it's still information, but the margin is just tons smaller. It's just much smaller. Mm-hmm. You know, it's certainly, you know, like you said, you know, it's not like the 1980s where, you know, if you lived in San Diego, the only way to find out about the Red Sox is if you had a friend in Boston who could read you Peter Gammon's column. So, but today, I think it might not be the information itself, but figuring out how to apply the information. And I think that's a step that not everybody knows how to do. And, you know, like here's a decision that I've had to make this weekend, not knowing I have the information, but I don't know what to do with it. You know, if you knew for a fact that Cole Sulcer is really the closer of choice in Baltimore, then that's a potential edge. But now you have to decide whether to cut Michael Givens. And you have to wonder why you're even worrying about the Orioles bullpen, because it's the Orioles. And then you take a look and realize they're 5-3 and in second place. I mean, yes, this season's crazy, but this is, you know, information and trying to figure out how to use the information. So I think that's still an edge if you could figure that out. As far as the metrics, I think there still may be a new statistical revolution coming at some point. I think we need to still accumulate more of a critical mass of data with things like exit velocities and barrels and spin rates and things like that. And there has to be something predictive that we can tease out of that. And I don't know what that is, but the first analyst who finds that will probably get to win a few years of experts leagues until all the rest of us catch up. So I think maybe there's something there.
Sure. I mean, to be fair, sometimes you see a stat come out and it's treated like the be all end all. And then we learn that you can really cut it up and get more specific with it. I think of when the BABIP, when the whole idea of what Forrest McCracken came out with is, okay, pitchers don't have control. Originally, the idea was that pitchers didn't have control over the batted balls, you know, whether you were Greg Maddux or just some rag arm, you know, seventh starter on a team. You know, we've since found out that isn't completely true. And what was maybe originally supposed by BABIP and Forrest McCracken isn't, you know, we found there are, okay, maybe somebody can induce weak contact with certain things. I feel like we understand batted ball metrics and that part of the game a lot better than maybe we did when it first came around 15 years ago. I mean, that's been worked on. We've improved on it.
Yeah, and it's just process, you know, and more and more people who get their hands dirty in the analysis, the closer we get to having a better idea of how to manage these numbers. But, you know, in the end, this is still a game played by human beings who have varying levels of talent and are able to recover from injury at various paces, and it's still humans. So there is a limit to what we will be able to predict, and we just have to try to do the best we can.
Now, again, as I mentioned earlier, Lima Plan was just, it's one of the watershed moments in fantasy baseball discovery. And it can be challenging sometimes when somebody comes up with a great discovery and it's recognized and celebrated and you got, you know, due props for it. You won a bunch of leagues and people recognized it. And it's like, okay, a couple of years go by. It's like, all right, Shandler, what else you got? You know, and I know you've worked on, you know, at one point, one of your strategies was portfolio three. I know the Mayberry method was something you fooled around with. The Babs broad asset balance sheet is your watershed thing that you do now. Just talk about a little bit about the challenge of once you have that really big hit and it puts you on the map, you go from maybe more of some people know about you, now you're the guy. And it's like, well, what do you do now? You know, you've just put out Sgt. Pepper. What do you do now? I just talk about what that search has been like since Lima and maybe what, you know, without giving away the store, just a little bit of what's going on with Babs.
Well, sure. You know, the world gets smarter all around you, and you're kind of a spectator to that. And it's wonderful to watch, because even if I had just a little bit of a contribution to having people think differently about the game, and I don't claim to be anywhere near of an impact as Bill James was, but I'm watching some of the analysis going on now, and it's wonderful. So for me, it's a lot of it is trying to find different ways to stay relevant and trying to find different ways to use other people's work with, you know, some Chandler coloring to provide some interesting content to my readers. And clearly, I don't consider myself to be able to do the pioneering type work that some other analysts are doing now. And that's fine, because I mean, I'm 62 years old. I've been at this now for 35 years, and it's time for some younger guys to take the baton and start doing some great stuff. And they are. So what I'm doing is trying to find different little avenues and different corners that I can still, prosper in and provide some value to my readers. And the broad assessment balance sheet, has been one of those areas. And it kind of was an evolution of thinking for me, because for the longest time, I thought that the be-all and end-all to nailing this game was to have the best set of projections and to have the most precise and accurate projections. And over the last 10 years, I realized that projective accuracy is almost doesn't even matter at all, because it's something that we really can't attain at the level we need to in order to successfully compete in this game. It's just almost impossible. So that's how Babs started, really. It was it began with the premise that it's nearly impossible to project performance with enough precision for it to be useful, because you can have a guy who hits 35 home runs and bats 280, and then the next year he hits 45 home runs and bats 250, and he's essentially the same guy. But we're looking at the numbers and trying to find trends when really there are no trends that exist, because variance and the error bars, they're wider than we're willing to admit. So basically what Babs says is that the best we can do is describe these underlying skills in very broad tiers. We can categorize them as below average, moderate, significant, extreme. And these tiers are defined by advanced metrics, but they're still these very wide tiers. And then we assemble these various ratings into a profile. Then that's on the asset side of the balance sheet. Then we have the liability side of the balance sheet, where we rate players' health and experience in a variety of lesser variables. And then the beauty of this thing is that we group players with like profiles and then sort them by their ADPs. So we can see how the marketplace places value on the skills and where the profit opportunities are. So let me give you an example in practice. A player could have significant power, below average speed, and significant batting average. And that's the profile of Nolan Arenado. But it's also the profile of Anthony Rendon, Paul Goldschmidt, and Nick Castellanos. So if you wanted Arenado, you'd have to use a first-round pick to get him. But you could wait for Castellanos at pick like 100 and still get essentially the same skill set within the normal margin of error. So that's how you build the profit on your roster. And Babs sets up all these buckets of players with like skills so you can see where to draft them. So,
and Castellanos looking, you know, again, a small sample of 2020. Every time I look up, he seems like he's hammering the ball or hitting the ball into the seats. I enjoyed watching him in Detroit. I've been a Michigan native for about 20 years now, and he was one of the few things the Tigers have had the last couple of years. Then he went to Chicago, and of course, I don't think anybody got him out when he was on the Cubs, and off to a good start with the Reds. And you know, that's, I think, a huge part of what makes a good player now is understanding how to leverage the market and see what will, you know, we have so much information now with ADP. We can go to NFBC website, and we can see the ADP. You can cut it up any way you want. You can say, what's the ADP for the last month, you know, with outfielders? And you can see what the market is giving you. And so it sounds like what Babs can do is find out what opportunities, what did Billy Beane do with Moneyball and the whole idea of the ace is what was the market inefficiency? What was not being priced correctly with free agents, and how could we take advantage? It sounds like Babs is kind of doing a little bit of the same thing.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it's doing. And it's more of a formalized way for us to be able to look at these players in groups and be able to see, you know, what their price tag is. And that's exactly what it is. Do you want to pay $20 for this commodity that you could get for 10? That helps us see that.
you mentioned Bill James earlier, and I think if we have a Bill James in fantasy baseball, I think it would have to be you. And I don't know if everybody realizes this because, again, you know, the game, you know, as we get up in years, more generations get introduced to fantasy sports, get introduced to fantasy baseball. You actually stepped out of the industry for a minute, and you were an analyst for the St. Louis Cardinals.
Yes, I was.
I know it wasn't. It was a relatively short stint, and I know yes. It wasn't. We didn't talk about this earlier. Yeah. You can talk as little about this as you want to, but I just want people to know that your work was respected enough that a major league club knocked on your door and said, "Hey, come work for us."
Yeah. Okay, I don't mind talking about it. It's been 15 years, and I plan on writing about it soon. And especially now, it's more relevant because the guy who hired me was Jeff Luhnow.
So, I wonder what he's up to.
But the story quite simply is he was a reader of the Baseball Forecaster, and he was familiar with my work, and the Cardinals hired him to basically work on player development analysis, and he basically had no baseball background. So he decided that he was going to surround himself with baseball people and create this advisory group. So he reached out to me, and I brought in several of my writers from Baseball HQ, and there were some people from other organizations. And basically, we just had ongoing discussions during the course of the 2004 season. I guess from my perspective, I was looking to get more out of it than I thought I got. And he kind of led us to believe that we would have some sort of input into the decision-making process, even from a distance, when in fact what happened during the course of that season is that we kept feeding them information when they asked for it, and we got zero feedback. So we didn't know whether they were looking at our information at all, whether they were using it, whether it was even good. And without that type of feedback, you feel like you're spinning your wheels. So what happened that I ended up pulling out of that agreement after a year, because it started actually to conflict with my work in fantasy baseball, which was kind of weird, but it did. Because that fall, we had published a Baseball Forecaster, and we gave a terrible write-up to a pitcher, Mark Mulder. And the Cardinals went out and they got him that winter. And so my readers were like, what's the deal? Do you have any impact on their decision-making? Or did you write poorly about Mulder to decrease his market value so they could get him cheaply? It was all a lot of garbage, really. But it made me recognize that I had to continue working where my bread was being buttered, and that was the fantasy baseball community. And although I got to experience and see how the sausage was made, and that was exactly what it felt like, watching sausage being made in the Major League Baseball front office. But I'm much happier being where I enjoy playing fantasy baseball and participating in the experts leagues and writing for my readers. One of the things also is that there have been quite a few people who've moved from fantasy into front offices, and they've been great voices who've been silenced since moving into front offices because they mm-hmm. can't write anymore. And, I think about Matt Olkin, I think about Jason Gray, and these guys are now working for major league teams, and I give them all the credit in the world, but I just enjoy this game too much.
Yeah, Dave Cameron went from Fangraphs to the Padres not that long ago, and I forget the timeline, so it may have not overlapped, but the Padres, around when they hired Cameron, also signed Eric Hosmer, and a lot of people thought, this may not be a good signing for you, and it probably seemed like a thing that maybe Cameron wouldn't have been in favor of. But again, I don't remember the exact timeline of that. I don't want to put it on Dave. It's just funny sometimes that you see teams that have very modern data-driven analysis, but that doesn't mean that somebody else couldn't have a different way of looking at things. And somebody else is signing the checks. Somebody else is the GM, and they may consider those things, but they may ultimately make their own decision.
Well, for me, I come away from the experience. I can always say that I worked for the Cardinals when they won the National League title and lost to the Red Sox in the World Series.
Hey, I'm a Red Sox fan, so there's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. So you mentioned a book, and you told me offline that one of the things you're working on or thinking of working on right now is a book. So since I'm here to blow your cover on everything I can possible, why don't we talk about that?
Sure. Well, you know, like I said, I've been doing this now for 35 years, and I've accumulated tons and tons of information. I'm a bit of a pack rat. I've got every email I've sent and received that was important, probably for the past 25 years. And I've got paper files, and I've got every Baseball Weekly, Sports Weekly, Leviathan since the very beginning. And I figured I've got this history. I remember a good deal of it. I probably should write about the history of the industry. So I've started the process. I've done a lot of the research. I've got an outline and a structure, and the tentative title for this book is going to be Fantasy Experts, which is in many ways completely ironic, because I've always hated the term fantasy and I've hated being considered an expert. But all the people who've made this industry, particularly those of my contemporaries in the 1980s and 1990s, have fascinating stories. And I've had a lot of very interesting interactions, the beginning of the labor league, the beginning of tout wars. And there's a book there. So I've started the process and started a little bit of the writing. And I don't want to put a deadline on myself, but to do it right, I'm probably thinking spring of 2022. But that's my pet project right now.
Wow, it sounds great. I can't wait to read it, and I hope I wish you well with that. And I'm sure there'd be a lot of a captive audience if and when that book got published. You know, it's funny. I'm a huge history guy. I love sports. I love history. I love documentaries. And I really have enjoyed the 30 for 30 documentary series on ESPN. I think they do amazing work. But it's funny. And maybe this is because I'm just too close to the story. One of the few 30 for 30s I didn't enjoy was the fantasy one. I thought, wow, this is going to be my favorite 30 for 30. And I watched it. And again, maybe I can't be objective because I'm too close. I'm in the middle of it. This is what I do. But it's just so funny that I don't know. It just wasn't the 30 for 30 for me. Did you see that 30 for 30? And did you have any thoughts on it?
I was in that 30 for 30.
Yeah. It's a long time. It's been several watches.
Yeah, I had my 4 seconds of fame. I was in the studio for like an hour, and I got 4 seconds near the tail end of it. It was a very different treatment for them. It was kind of – they took fantasy to the real fantasy level. With characters and whatnot, it was sort of a caricature of the industry. I don't think they gave it the seriousness that it deserved, and that's probably attributable to the fact that we do still call this fantasy, which I hate. But it was definitely not one of their better efforts.
Yeah, I didn't think it was either. And I want to be very clear. I have an enormous respect and reverence for the founding fathers of fantasy, the late Glenn Wagoner, who died fairly recently, just a ton of respect for him, and Dan Okrent, who of course was, you know, had a literary background, and Robert Sklar. And I actually played in Rob Fletter was one of the, I think I'm saying that right, was one of the original Roto guys, and his son was actually in a Roto league of mine. We happened to become friendly and invite him to a league. And I said, you know, the name sounds familiar. He said, yeah, you probably know who my dad is. So those guys, they created a game. Because when I was a kid, I loved baseball cards. I loved This Week in Baseball. I loved the complete handbook of baseball. I was just a baseball junkie. But I just liked the stats because I thought they were cool. I had no application for them. And then one year they gave me my parents gave me a game that was very similar to Strat. I think it was a Avalon Hill baseball, mm-hmm. or something similar to APA. A lot of people have played. And, you know, that's given me a lot of joy. There's a lot of different ways to get into baseball and get into stats. And so I just want to make it clear that founding fathers group, you know, they affected my life. I would like to individually just all of them just say, hey, thank you. You did something that has brought a lot of enjoyment to my life.
Yeah. They, It's amazing in doing the research for the history and finding out more about how everything kind of coalesced and came together. It's kind of fascinating, and even more so the fact that there was a lot of cross-pollination between the rotisserie genre and the sabermetric genre. I had forgotten that Dan Okrent actually discovered Bill James. He is the one,
right.
He wrote that first article for I believe it was Inside Sports about Sounds Bill right. James, and that was like 3 years before the Rotisserie League Baseball book came out. So there was always a kind of a commingling of this new thought process, and it was interesting that commercially the two genres kind of developed a little bit differently, in separate paths. But now it's, I think, in a lot of ways, it's completely together that we were so involved in the metrics. In order to run our teams that, again, it's just a fascinating evolution of how information has happened.
Well, it sounds like you get a great book on your hands. You're just going to have the time to write it. Mm-hmm. But I can't wait to go through some of those stories. And I'm sure it's going to be a great volume when you're done with it. We're talking to Ron Chandler, just one of the most important people in fantasy baseball. A guy really taught us how to play and how to dig into metrics, and sharing us some ideas where we're going, where we're headed. Now we're going to pivot to our fun draft. Call this the Jose Lima draft. This is the just breakout players that we like. These are not competitive. Nobody scores this. We're just a chance for us to talk about five players that interest us. Ron, you are my guest. I'm going to give you first pick in the Jose Lima breakout player draft.
Yeah, and before you said I get to keep Jose Lima no matter when I draft him, right? So I'm
yeah, it's a keeper league. Yeah. Where you get a keeper, and I don't. So it's a terrible organization by me.
Well, okay, I'm going to pass on Jose Lima for my first pick because for me personally, there was a player before that led me to Jose Lima.
Okay,
and that breakout was Denny Nagel in 1995. He was the player who got me interested in trying to figure out breakout performances. At the very beginning, his first few years in Pittsburgh, he couldn't get his ERA under 5. Then in 1995, he went 13-8 with a 3.43 inning and 209 innings. And I was just like, how the hell does that happen? And I was committed to figuring out how somebody who was completely undraftable in my fantasy league suddenly became a star pitcher. And that's when the process started. So Denny Nagel started that for me.
Great pick. I'm going to start with, I know this is a name that some people are a little bit frustrated by because he kind of broke fantasy when he broke out, but I'm going to go with Jose Bautista, who, you know, we see it now all the time where a player changes his approach, changes his launch angle, changes his swing, and maybe hits a bunch of home runs. I mean, they're okay. You know, we've seen this story before, but I feel like Jose Bautista was one of the first people, even before we kind of knew what people were doing. He went with a different approach the previous year. He hit a bunch of home runs in September. I know a lot of times that stuff is noise. You're playing against these AAA rosters sometimes. But he showed a little bit of the power in the previous season. And then, man, he just went crazy with that 54-homer season and had several MVP quality contending seasons after that. So I feel like the thing with Bautista for me is that it was a reminder of just when you see plausible upside, sometimes if you don't even need a great explanation for it, sometimes you just have to say, okay, maybe this there's a chance this is real. I'll pick this guy up and you know, 2 weeks or 3 weeks later when it looks silly, I'll drop him and pick up somebody else. I think you have to be open-minded to what plausible upside can look like. And I think Bautista in 2010 really hammered that home for me.
Yeah, well, he was the guy I was going to pick my third round pick, but that's okay.
Good. I've scouted well.
Yeah,
I've scouted well off the Chandler cheat sheet.
Yeah, there you go. So I'll go with Jose Lima for my second pick. Jose Lima, 1998. I was looking for the pitcher who fit the Denny Nagel mold at the first Tout Wars draft. Lima had just been named the number 4 starter for the Houston after 3 years with ERAs as high as I think it was 6.11. About two-thirds of the way through the draft, I called out his name for a dollar and got crickets.
Sure.
And he won 16 games with a 3.70 ERA and helped me win the league that year.
Was there a moment when you realized not only did this pick click, but like this is going to be a watershed thing? I mean, when did you kind of sense that, okay, it wasn't like, oh, I got a $1 pitcher and he's a $10 pitcher, but it's like, oh, man, this is a game changer.
It was probably maybe 6 weeks into the season, and I was like, wow, this might really work. Because to be honest, when I picked him and got crickets, I mean, you know what it's like when you make a pick in an auction league and nobody else bids against you, and you think maybe you made a mistake. And I'm sitting there thinking, I just, something happened here. This was really stupid. I shouldn't have done this. But yeah, maybe a month and a half into the season, I said, all right, maybe this thing actually works.
I'm going to take in the second round. I'm going to take Cliff Lee because I really love the shape of his career. He came up with the Indians in the early 2000s, and you know, it was 14-8-1 year. He was a Cy Young contender in 2005. And a couple of years later, just kind of forgot how to pitch. He 4.40 ERA. And I'm saying ERA. We know ERA now is not the greatest way to maybe describe a pitcher, but it's still very portable and accessible. So I'll use that for the sake of this argument. 2007, he collapses. His ERA is 6.29. Nobody wants anything to do with Cliff Lee. And I remember watching him pitch early in the 2008 season against the Yankees, and he was spotting his fastball anywhere he wanted. And I think I might have read a Joe Sheehan article, our guest last week and our mutual friend of Ron's and mine. I think Joe Sheehan might have written an article about Lee after this game against the Yankees. Like, man, I believe what he's doing. I know it's only been a few starts. Well, it turns out Cliff Lee goes 22-3, 2.54 ERA, led the league, Cy Young Award winner. And it just kind of taught me to be open-minded that pitching is difficult. And muscle memory comes and goes, and you can change your spot on the rubber. You can have a new pitching coach. You can have a new catcher. There can be so many reasons why pitchers fail and why pitchers succeed. A lot of times when they fail, it's because they get hurt. But I think Cliff Lee just opened my mind to, it's not that Cliff Lee is good. It's not that Cliff Lee stinks. It's that, you know, Cliff Lee, and what's the famous Chandler's? And once you display a skill, you own it. I guess we could say that there were skills that Cliff Lee displayed early in his career, and he reminded everybody in 2008 that he still owned those skills.
Yeah, I've sometimes been taken to task for that phrase, so I've kind of modified it. Once you display a vulnerability, you own that as well. So,
sure,
yeah,
sure,
yeah. My next pick, I'm going to go with Paul LaDuca in 2001, and particularly because he's a catcher, and catchers are just so hard to find breakouts in. He was already 29 coming into that season, and prior to that, he only had like three partial seasons where he hit maybe in total about 250. At Baseball HQ, we saw something there and said he had like 300 potential, maybe a little bit of pop, but nobody really expected him to hit 25 home runs and bat 320. So for a catcher, that was a real nice fantasy end game payday.
Yeah, it's always nice to hit on a cheap player, especially a catcher. Have you tended to be – what's been your catcher strategy over the years? Would you be somebody who pay up for the vanity catcher or try to play the middle of the market or just go with $1 catchers or just depend on the year? Where have you really come down on that with catchers?
Well, particularly in two catcher leagues, I've always tried to go for the mid-level mid-level catcher for a start and make sure my second catcher to have somebody who – might be a $1 catcher, but is actually not worth minus five, which usually the bottom half of the catcher pool is actually a negative catcher pool. So I try to avoid those negative catchers and just draft someone just before they reach that point and hope for the best.
That makes sense. My third pick, I'm going to take Sean Green's 1998 season, 278, 35, 100 RBIs. And the reason I'm going to take Green, and look, you can be right in fantasy for the wrong reasons, or you can be right and not even know why you're right. At the time of Green, I looked at his career path and the shape of it, and it reminded me of Larry Walker, who at that point, he was the 1997 MVP and had become a full-fledged star. And there were certain similarities I saw. And you think of what happens now, you can go on Baseball Reference and see similar players are linked. The world is kind of – it's the algorithm world right now. If you watch three or four movies on Netflix, it will say, hey, you might want to watch these other movies. Or if you're friends with Ron Chandler on Twitter, it might suggest, hey, you might want to be friends with Ray Murphy or Jeff Erickson, whoever it is. It's an algorithm world. I want to believe – I have no proof of this. I want to believe that there's something about Walker that I saw that was related to Green and the improvement was linear and it popped. I have no idea if that stands up to any intelligent statistical analysis, but – by the time the late 90s came around, I was actually doing some fantasy writing. So this was one of the first times I gave out. I told people, hey, I think Sean Green's going to pop this year. I want you to get this guy. And you talked about earlier. I mean, we work really for our readers. It's great if we can have individual success, but what's more rewarding than if somebody comes to you and say, Hey, Ron, I use Babs. I won my league. I mean, what's more satisfying than that? And Green, I think, was the first time where I gave something out and people could say, hey, thanks. You gave me a guy who clicked. I don't know if the reasons why I gave out Green were legitimate, but I know we had a lot of fun with him in 98.
That's cool. Let's see. For my next pick, I'm going to go with Jake Arrieta in 2015.
He's on my board.
Yeah. I mean, he always had the pedigree. We thought he would do well in Baltimore, and he just could not get it together. He just had some actually awful seasons with the Orioles. But then he came to Chicago, and he started turning things around. And then in 2015, 22 wins, 177 ERA, led the league in complete games and shutouts. Was a phenomenal season. And rather than just that being a one-off, I mean, he continued to be productive for several years after that. So that's why I pick Arrieta.
You know, Baltimore, they've had so much trouble developing their prospects. You know, Arrieta got out of Baltimore. His career blossomed. Obviously, Trevor Bauer has been a much better pitcher in different cities. There's some people think maybe Dylan Bundy could be blossoming in Anaheim now that he's no longer tied to the Orioles. Is that something the Orioles can't seem to get out of their own way with pitching? Do you believe in any of that? Do you think organizational, just sometimes, I know in fantasy football, a lot of people have looked at the Jets and say, hey, people seem to leave Adam Gase and good things seem to happen. It could be coincidence. You know, when things line up, it doesn't, I'm missing the tidy way to say this, but just because two stats line up doesn't mean that there's significance to it. What do you think about pitchers getting out of Baltimore? Could that be a hook that we can use?
It's possible. I mean, Camden Yards is not a great stadium to pitch in. It's more of a hitter's park. There's a history there. I don't like to make broad statements about stuff like this, because a lot of it has to do with individual players. But when you see somewhat of an underlying trend, for me, it's something I would tuck away in my back pocket. And if I had to make a decision between two pitchers and of similar caliber, I might steer away from the Oriole.
Makes sense. What I was looking for, stumbling very awkwardly, is correlation, as we know, is not causation. Right. So just something we have to keep in the back of our minds. Fourth round, I'm going to pick J.D. Martinez. And this is just a great reminder that, you know, the Astros, for all the things the Astros have done that we're not happy about, and if you want to boo in the comfort of your own home or car right now, that's fine. But they've done a lot of smart things over the years, too. And they had J.D. Martinez. They gave him some playing time. Didn't really work out. They cut him. And nobody in baseball really wanted J.D. Martinez. Went to Detroit in 2014. Studied with Miguel Cabrera. Tool, again, much like earlier with Bautista, Martinez was one of those early guys. How can I change my swing? How can I fix my swing? And it had a breakout in 2014. He didn't become a full-fledged superstar until maybe the next year. But I remember being impressed enough with Martinez that I had a day off one day at Yahoo. And I said, on this particular day off, I just told my boss, I said, you know, I think everybody needs to add J.D. Martinez. I'm just going to run on the blog and throw this out here. It's kind of before Twitter became a place where you might do that now. But I just want people, I believe in this. I think it's a real thing. And so it was just fun. Like, the Astros are a smart team, whatever you want to say about some of the noise there. They got Martinez wrong. Maybe just Martinez wasn't ready to be the player he was going to be. Maybe there was just no getting it right with Martinez at that time. But just to show that, you know, somebody can change their approach. Somebody can change how they work out, how they eat, how they swing. And you can take somebody who nobody in baseball wants a year or two later, that guy might be a star.
Cool. So this is my last pick.
Last pick.
Okay, I'm actually going to say three players, and hopefully that none of them conflict with yours. But I was looking through the list of ADPs from the last 15 years and versus actuals. And I was looking for players who finished with number one earnings for a season, but they basically earned the most roto dollars in the course of the season and were neither in the ADPs for the first few rounds and never repeated in the first round again. And I thought these were interesting guys to look at. And there were three of them in particular. It was in 2011, Matt Kemp, 39 home run season, 126, 40 stolen bases.
Steals,
a .324 batting average. Never finished as a first round earner again. Carlos Gonzalez in 2010, 34 homers, 26 steals, .336 batting average. Never finished anywhere near the first round again. And in 2005, Derek Lee, 46 home runs, .335 batting average. basically these were one-hit wonders. And it's interesting that these are the guys that you can't predict, and then their ADPs typically are inflated the following season, and they never pay back what you spend for them ever again, which is always interesting to look at guys like this.
Yeah, I think you've done some work with that, with ADP fluctuation. Like, when you go the next year, like, wait a minute, all of a sudden this guy's really expensive. Or wait a minute, we liked this player a year ago. Why don't we like him now?
Yeah, and because what tends to happen is that we have a lot of recency bias thinking. And so we are constantly view just one season's worth of stats and think that that has a higher weight in our memory for evaluating these players, when in fact, we really need to take a look at the entire track record and see where that season fits in.
Yeah. Understanding recency bias is a great tool in the toolbox to have. I mean, we talked about Crawford earlier, about the recency bias with him is that, oh, he stunk the last couple of years. Well, for one thing, maybe he really wasn't that bad last year, but just look back, squint back a little bit when he was a really highly regarded prospect. Now you're getting him for basically nothing. He's a replacement player now. You may have gotten him in your last round. You may have gotten him as a $0 pickup or something like that. So that's a case of post-type sleeper is just another way of using recency bias to your advantage. The rest of the room is cleared out, and then you can get the player at your own price. Two guys I have listed here who I'll mention. AJ Pollock was somebody I gave out a lot in 2015. It was just a case of, I think he just needed to stay healthy. He had played really well for about half of a season in 2014, had a first round pedigree out of Notre Dame, did stay healthy in 2015, 20 home runs, 39 steals, 111 runs. And unfortunately, he's had trouble staying healthy since. But that was just a case of all we had to ask ourselves is, this guy can stay on the field and get commitment from the Diamondbacks. He looks like a potential star. And I have a soft spot in my heart for Nate McLouth, 2008, 26 homers, 23 steals, 113 runs. At the time, I was working for Fantasy Guru, and we had a message board that I was on every day. And I'm not going to say there were a ton of us there, but we had some loyal readers. And I feel like every one of us had McLouth. We would just celebrate together when he would hit a homer, steal a base. And we all got him in late rounds of drafts. Some people might have even picked him up. And again, you know, I like to be right for my teams. It's that satisfying. I like to be competitive in a league or win a league. I mean, who doesn't? But there's something about when you give that out to the people who believe in you or the people who follow you, and you all communally gain from that. There's just something special about that feeling.
Yeah, that's great. That's great.
All right. Well, this has been a blast. We could easily do like 3 hours with Ron Chandler, and I can't wait. Again, I hope that that book you were talking about, I hope that goes well, and I can't wait to read it. Ron, tell everybody how they can keep up with what you're up to.
Well, the main site where I'm hanging my hat is babsbaseball.com. But I also have my personal site, ronchandler.com, which is still kind of under construction. It's going to be just sort of a vanity site, essentially, just sort of one place to keep all of my work over the past 30-some-odd years. I'm on Twitter at Ron Chandler. I've got a Facebook page, baseball.ronchandler. And, that's pretty much it.
Well, I want to wish you good luck in winning that that hometown league. So you're in Florida now, right?
I am in Florida. Yes. Yeah. We just had a little tropical storm pass by us. Luckily, it wasn't too bad. I've been in Florida now for about 6 years and love dodging these hurricanes. But now we're dodging a virus, which is kind of a little scary here, too. But we're doing all right. Hanging in there.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Well, I hope you enjoy the rest of the season. Again, I can't thank you enough for having you on. You really, truly haven't been a fantasy baseball podcast until you have somebody like Ron Chandler on. So it means so much to take the time with us. We hope the listeners have enjoyed this conversation. For Ron Chandler, for my producer Raghu on the West Coast, keeping us on the air and sounding great, I am Scott Pianowski. Follow me on Scott_Pianowski if you like. And we'll be back in a week talking more fantasy baseball. Thanks for hanging with us. Talk to you soon.